Mary Nelson says that because of the pain associated with her disability, having the option to cast her vote early in Illinois is important.
I would not otherwise be able to go to a polling place, and I would have to stand in a long line, and that's difficult for my disability, for my back and my hip. I would really prefer to be able to walk in, vote, and walk out.
As we continue our week-long conversations looking at identity and politics, we talk about one group you may not hear from that often, voters with disabilities. Also, a few weeks after the shooting near the University of Illinois campus, we talk about, to quote one professor, the racial Pandora's box it's opened. And
Javier Baez with an RBI single has given the Cubs a 6-5 lead.
That's ESPN Radio's call from last night's historic come-from-behind win for the Chicago Cubs. It's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. It's a great day for Cubs fans. We're going to be talking about that later in the show. But first, a recent Pew Research report on the political profile of Americans with disabilities finds that 20% of those voters who turned up to vote in 2015 said their illness or disability made it, quote, too difficult to vote. All week on the 21st, we've been talking about some issues that are important to various constituencies as the presidential election approaches. It's part of a national NPR Nation Engage conversation that many member stations are taking part in. Perhaps you heard some of the stories this morning on Morning Edition. Today, we wanted to focus in on a group you don't hear very much about, that's voters with disabilities. What are the challenges unique to this group and what's being done to remove these barriers? I'm joined now in studio by Mary Nelson. She's a retiree who lives in Champaign. Mary, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Also on the line with us from Springfield, Ann Ford is the executive director of the Illinois Network of Centers for Independent Living. Ann, welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us as well.
Thank you.
Mary, we actually had the idea to do this conversation because of a tweet you sent out. And you said, because I walk with a cane and I have trouble walking and standing, I vote early so I don't have to wait in line. Others don't have that option. I wonder if you can help give us a sense of the kinds of things that have made it difficult to vote for you. What's your experience been in the past?
Well, you may remember in 2008, there was a record voter turnout when Obama ran the first time, and I waited in line for well over an hour to vote that year. And then again in 2012, I waited in line for quite some time because I was still working, and I was trying to get my vote in before I went to work. This year, when I voted in the primaries, I was able to early vote because Champaign County has early voting. And I was able to just park my car, walk a very short distance. There was no line. I got in, voted, got out, and there was no waiting. And the reason that that's important to me is because since I've been retired, I've actually had some health issues that have caused me difficulty in walking and standing. The longer I walk, the longer I stand, the more pain I have. So I literally need short distances to get to a voting booth.
When you had to stand in line for that, for I think it was 2008, how long were you waiting in line?
Probably an hour and a half.
Oh, wow. That's tough.
Yeah. And that's before I got in to vote.
Okay. And then you had to wait, of course, when you got into the polling facility.
That's right.
To get to a station. And how different, can you contrast that with what happened with your early voting this year?
Yes, this year I walked in, walked right up to one of the people that was checking my registration, was given a ballot, and within 2 or 3 minutes I was in a booth, I voted, and I would say my entire experience was less than 10 minutes from getting out of my car to getting back to my car.
And according to a report that Pew did last month, and we'll tweet out the link to that report, by the way, if everybody would like to see the information about it. It's got lots of demographic information. 1 in 4 Americans identify as having a disability. And Mary's been talking to us about the problem. That's a very clear problem of waiting, standing in long lines to wait to vote. That may be a problem for some people. What are other barriers for participation in the political process for people with various disabilities?
Well, I think there can be a whole range of barriers. I mean, certainly the ones Mary talked about, and added to some of those physical issues are things that we have no control over, such as the weather. I also am a person with a physical disability, and I no longer walk. I use a scooter. But when I walked, it would really be difficult if it was pouring down rain or snow. So that's one thing that can have an impact. The other thing is the accessibility of the polling place. And more we are seeing accessible polling places. There are laws in place, and there are advocacy groups that do a pretty good job of monitoring. Some of the other things, when you get into the larger realm of disabilities, people who either can't see or can't hear have added issues. Somebody who can't see clearly needs somebody to assist them in the voting process. And I have really heard people describe that as a pretty frightening thing, because you have no way of knowing. If you say to somebody, I want to vote for this person and this person.
Right, you don't know that they did that. That's true.
You don't know if they do that or not. So that's an issue. People who can't hear, very often, the judges and the people in the polling place maybe are a little nervous about that. People react in funny ways. So that can be a problem. Anybody with a cognitive disability or with a communication disability is going to run into some problems. So there's a whole variety of issues that can arise that can make it harder. And for some people, might be what makes them decide they're just not going to do it.
And Anne, as you say that, I wonder if you can, well, you said that there have been some changes with laws. Right now in Illinois, what are the requirements, what are the federal requirements for making polling places accessible?
I wish I could cite you the laws, and I can't, but under both the Americans with Disabilities Act and the Help America Vote Act, I believe both of them address this, and polling places are required to be accessible to people with disabilities, which would mean that they have to be there have to be no steps, there have to be no revolving doors, things like that. That somebody with a disability, a mobility limiting disability, would have a problem with. Some of the things that aren't always addressed are the distance from maybe where you park your car to where you go in. If that's a lengthy walk, that can even be a problem. If somebody has a limitation in terms of how much time they can stand up, how far they can walk, that kind of thing.
Under the law,
they are required to be accessible.
As Anne's talking about that, I imagine it sounds like you probably did quite a bit of homework before. I don't know if you called your the early voting place. I think there's probably a lot more preparation that's required for you to think about the parking space, the length of time walking, all of those sorts of things. How did you manage that this year?
Actually, I did call Champaign County and talk to them about when did early voting start. And then the other thing that happened this year, which is kind of difficult, is I went to their website to see, okay, which polling places could I use? And I did not notice the dates. I just looked at the times. And one of the things that's interesting right now is that really it's at the county clerk's office, which is the only place currently that you can vote today if you wanted to go today. Now, as of October 24th, there'll be a larger number of polling places. But I accidentally went to my polling place, I think last Friday.
And it wasn't open.
But the reason that I won't go to Champaign County Clerk's office is because of that very thing that Ann just mentioned. The walk is far too long for me to go into that building. And the building is kind of a maze, so I don't know if I'll be going directly or if I'm going to have to walk around a variety of places. So I'm going to wait until my polling place is open on October 24th so that I can have that shorter distance to walk That's very important. And the idea of doors is also very important. And for some people, those automatic doors make all the difference. They cannot open those heavy doors. So I think people in Champaign County, at least, need to make sure that they know not just where they're going to vote, but also the dates and times that those polling places are open.
I do want to get to issues in a moment, but Anne, I just wanted to ask you about what outreach that you all have done at the Illinois Network of Centers for Independent Living to help encourage people. I know that individual centers are doing work, especially where you are in Springfield.
And really, that's pretty much statewide. They all of the centers do things a little differently because they're part of their own community. But I believe that we have 22 centers throughout the state, and every one of them has some kind of a voter registration drive, because we want to be sure that people are registered, and then a get-out-the-vote drive. Some of them are able to go as far as being able to use accessible vans and offer people transportation if they need it, because that's a big problem for a lot of people with physical disabilities. A lot of them are doing things within their centers, like having meetings and discussing the issues and the process of voting. And for people who maybe haven't voted before, they work with them they've even been able in some cases to bring in a voting machine and demonstrate to them this is exactly what you'll be doing, so that first-time experience isn't one that makes you say, I'm not going to do that again. And they all do outreach. Many of them, I think we're pretty far away from the days of old newsletters, which we used to do, but on their websites and on their Facebook pages, they put a lot of information about voting. And
it's nonpartisan. We should point that out. It's not.
Absolutely.
This is a completely nonpartisan effort that you
absolutely
do. It's just about getting people to the polls. To that point, Mary, I think that it's a really interesting landmark Senate race that we have here in Illinois. Historic because both of the candidates, both Representative Tammy Duckworth and the incumbent Senator Mark Kirk, both of them have physical disabilities. At times, both of them use wheelchairs. So whoever wins this race will be a senator who uses a wheelchair. They've both been very open about the challenges that they've faced and how they've adapted to their life. Representative Duckworth has talked very openly and honestly about how she's adapted to life after her military injury. Senator Duckworth, since his stroke. Do you think having politicians being that, it's not certainly, I don't think either of them have made this a central issue in their campaign, but it's just sort of part of the conversation of who they are as people. Do you think that helps kind of shed light on the whole idea that there's a whole constituency of voters who have disabilities?
Yes, I think that's really an important aspect, honestly, for how many millions of people who are eligible to vote, 34 million, I believe it is, that are eligible to vote who are disabled. That kind of representation means a lot because they understand the various issues. No matter what the disability, they are more open to hearing about what the issues are for disabled people. And I think that having a representative who understands what it is that you are going through really does make a difference. It's like having women in the Senate or the House. It's like having a representative who is of an ethnic minority or anything else that may be very important to you. So to me, it's very important.
Are there issues that matter to you personally as a person with a disability that you wish would have been addressed more, both whether we're talking about the presidential election or on a more local level, the Senate race, other local seats?
I haven't been disabled that long, so I'm not sure that I'm the right person to answer a question like that. I'm certainly experiencing physical disability because of various conditions that I've developed since I've been older, okay? But for I'm sure Anne can answer that question probably even better than I can because she knows the populations.
Anne, do you think there's enough attention given to issues that matter to voters with disability by politicians in general?
You know, I think they don't think about it in those terms. And part of the reality is almost every issue is going to be important in one way or another to people with disabilities. I think some of the issues that are as important to people with disabilities, if not more so, number one is the economy and the whole situation with jobs, because among the population of people with disabilities, the unemployment rate hardly ever gets down much below the 70% point.
Did you say 70%?
Yes.
70.
So
okay.
That's very important. Education is very important. Civil rights is extremely important. People don't always think about that in terms of people with disabilities, but it is, in fact, one of the big problems. If you are prevented from accessing any part of your community or your society because you're disabled, that's a violation of your civil rights. So, you know, we tend to look at it in those broader terms. I think all of that is extremely important. One of the things you said about the two candidates for senator that I think is also important is that neither of them has made disability a central part of their platform, which I think is a good thing, because I think very often people in the general public who don't know people with disabilities would think that if somebody gets elected, that's what they're going to work on only. And the reality is, if you're going to be a United States senator or an Illinois state senator, you have all of the many, many, many issues to deal with as your non-disabled peers.
Ann, can I stop you for just a second? Because we've just got to take a break. And there was one more question I was going to ask. If you can stick around after the break, I'd really appreciate it, because I do want to ask you about the center and the budget situation. I want to thank Mary Nelson for joining us. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We've been talking about voters with disabilities. My guest is Ann Ford. She's executive director of the Illinois Network of Centers for Independent Living. And just before the break, we weren't able to finish your thought. You were talking about Representative Tammy Duckworth and incumbent Senator Mark Kirk, and how you thought it was really important that while they're both candidates who have physical disabilities, that hasn't been a central point of their campaign. I just wanted you to be able to finish that thought if you could.
Sure. I mean, all I was saying was I think it's important for the whole general public to know that that won't be the focus of their attention when whichever one is elected senator is going to be faced with all of the issues that all of the other senators are. And our hope is that when something very specific to disability comes to their attention, they would be supportive of what we ask them about. But, people with disabilities are a part of our society, and we are part of every group you can imagine. Disability knows no barriers in terms of who it decides to visit. Doesn't care how old you are or how young you are or what gender you are, what race you are, what your ethnicity is, what your political beliefs are. So we're everywhere, and, that means that we're going to have opinions all over the place, and any elected official is going to have to understand that they might meet with two people today that are disabled, and they might both have different messages. But having them there doing the same thing that every other senator does, I think, is an important advancement in people with disabilities becoming accepted as just part of our society.
Before I let you go, Anne, one quick question. As you're talking about all the work the centers are doing, there are 22 different centers across Illinois. Have you been impacted by the state budget situation?
Yes, we have. All of our centers are funded by the state as part of their funding. And they're all different. Everything about them is different. So the amounts of funding they get and the proportion of funding that state is different. But every one of our centers was faced with situations where they had to lay people off. Many of them had to impose furlough days, which for that's almost a nice way of saying everybody takes a cut in pay.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because
it's a tough situation.
If you
sure.
have a furlough day once a week, that means that you've lost 20% of your income. Mm. It's been really, really difficult, and it of course isn't over yet. But it had pretty much the same impact that it's had on many other organizations. We have not so far had any center that actually had to close its doors, and we're just desperately hoping that that doesn't happen.
Let's hope that that doesn't happen. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for the work that you're doing. As we mentioned, nonpartisan work, helping people with disabilities get to polling places. There's got lots of links that we'll have up on our website at 21stshow.org and that we've tweeted out as well, resources for this. But I want to thank Ann Ford, Executive Director with the Illinois Network of Centers for Independent Living, for being with us. Thanks, Ann.
Thank you.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. About 2 weeks ago, there was a shooting on the campus of the near the campus of the University of Illinois. The tragedy ended the life of one young man, and another is now in custody and likely facing a lifelong sentencing. The shooting could have happened anywhere in the state, and unfortunately it often does, whether we're talking about Champaign, Springfield, Peoria, Chicago. But as we know, all shootings don't receive equal or same intention. In fact, as U of I African American Studies professor Sundiata Chajua wrote in the News Gazette, this particular incident opened up a, quote, racial Pandora's box. We're joined now by Professor Chajua, as well as U of I graduate student and Black Lives Matter activist Liv Winston, in studio with us to discuss this issue. Liv, Professor Chajua, thank you so much for being with me.
I'm glad to be here.
Professor, what did you mean when you said this opened up a racial Pandora's box when you wrote those words?
Well, you know, there's different responses to when black people kill other blacks. You don't get as much prison time. Oftentimes you don't get as serious an investigation, but you certainly don't get the concern in the broader community. But when a black person kills a white person, then suddenly, there's a wave of calls for punitive action, repression, and I think that we can see clearly the difference in the way in which the university and the city government responded to this shooting. Suddenly there's vigils for a person who is not even a citizen of Champaign, and there's a lot of concern being issued, statements by the mayor, and the year before, 8 black people were killed. Not one comment from any U of I official, not one comment from any city official other than Will Kyles.
And Liv, you wrote about this too. You're sitting here nodding. I guess the one thing I guess people would say about this is, well, this happened very close to campus, so maybe that's why this also got so much attention. But the way that you wrote about this, Liv, you wrote a blog post on the Black Lives Matter Champaign-Urbana website where you talked about what you wrote the danger of oversimplifying the narrative. And you wrote that Robbie Patton and George Korchef's media representation as a simple dichotomy only fuels the problem, not the discussion. What do you mean by that?
Correct. And like in many ways of what Sundiata pointed to with the News Gazette, there tends to be like this amongst journalism, just like this whole like need for like sensationalism. Like if you saw the News Gazette article's title, it said like it happened over a spilled drink when actually it was a lot deeper than that. And just kind of to show you how like they're trying to play off a narrative, not only to just get more reactions, but also just to simplify issue that we need to focus more so holistically on, like looking at gun laws, looking at like how violence perpetuates amongst like racial communities and how this continues to happen as well.
Professor, I wonder for you, what specifically did you see or hear? And you wrote about some of this in your piece that you actually wrote in the News Gazette. What specifically did you see or hear playing out after the shooting that you found most problematic?
Well, there was the Jim Turpin show. I can't think of it enough. Penny for Your Thoughts. There were callers who called in, and some of the stuff was just overtly racist, but most of it was subtly racist. And there was a particular a caller by the name of Bruce who expressed the sentiment that, first of all, he wished that when Robbie Patton was captured, that Patton would choose to shoot it out, in which case the police could kill him. And then he raised the question as to whether or not an organization that has a history of nothing but compliance to nonviolence would in fact burn down the city. That kind of sensationalism. But there were other things, more subtle things. There's a photo in the News Gazette in which a police lieutenant is standing in front of a wall-sized picture of Robbie Patton's face.
And, the accused, and, we should say. Mm-hmm. Right. The accused
shooter.
And
it gives the image. It gives the image of this kind of supernatural being that's haunting the space like some kind of specter. And it fits into the narrative. If you remember Darren Wilson, when he murdered Michael Brown, he says that Brown began to hawk up.
He seemed like he was charging at him.
Well, no, not just that he was charging at, but he compared him to the hawk. He literally claims that Brown was getting larger in size as he was coming at him. And he had earlier presented a notion that Brown had uncommon supernatural strength. So it's that kind of narrative. And I saw that the media here was feeding into that, particularly the callers on those talk shows.
Mm-hmm. Liv, for you, what else? I see you're nodding your head a lot in here. What else stood out for you among conversations? And I wonder, apart from the media and that representation, what else stood out for you, whether it's campus conversations that you heard on campus or within the community, about how this was discussed?
Very similar, just within the community, talking about, oh, where's Black Lives Matter for this? Like, totally, like, you know, not paying attention, you know, what actually is the cause of Black Lives Matter, and kind of just like to build off like the Incredible Hulk stuff. In my blog post, I posted the link of how police officers and other authorities tend to look at Black male individuals as stronger and superhuman power when actually, you know, it's just like built off those old beliefs and racism that still plague our system today.
And I, as you guys have pointed out, not just the media, we actually had our social media team analyze the data. And on a typical day, there's about 2,000 people who tweet about the University of Illinois. Mm-hmm. The day following the shooting, there were about 18,000 tweets about this, not just, of course, and we did that across the, you know, the world. That was all, mm-hmm. all tweets about this, not just in Champaign-Urbana, not just in Central Illinois or Illinois. But so I wonder what you all think. I mean, with that level of attention, and I do think with this case, certainly it happened near the biggest college campus, the largest state university in Illinois. It's a Big Ten school. I think those are a lot of reasons why it also got such national attention. But why do you think, what do you think needs to be changed in order to make the community more aware of all incidents of violence? Professor, you were talking about the previous shootings that have happened in the Champaign-Urbana area over this year so far.
Well, before I address that, let me make this point here. We are talking about an institution that certainly under Phyllis Wise gave Black youth who came onto the campus to use the outdoor basketball courts. They were charged with trespass and given a ticket that forced them to go to jail. You know, they either had to pay the ticket or run up fees. And so we are talking about an incredibly racist institution in terms of its dealings with the local Black community, particularly Black youth. So we need to get that on the table. And that's one of the reasons why this tremendous upsurge of concern for the young man who was killed seems to be a slap in the face, because there was no concern. And you know, you can say it's close to the campus, but portions of the campus are very close to the Black community, right? Mm-hmm. The effort on the part of the campus to lead, along with Carl, to lead a gentrification campaign by moving further and further into the historic Black community. So to say that it wasn't close to campus, some of those killings were very close to property owned by the campus. So it comes down in terms of race and class. And so we need to be clear about those aspects of it. Now, in terms of, you know, when you start thinking about what can we do to end gun violence, everything proposed, no matter how moderate, has been rejected by the citizenry of this society. The Congress refuses to put any restriction on gun control. In the last month, we've seen the state of Missouri pass a gun law that calls for not just open carry, but you have to do very little training, and you can take the weapons into the classroom. Mm-hmm. Texas has such a law. After President Obama was elected, you saw that there was something like an increase in gun ownership that was like 400%. So we are under no illusions that this effort to preserve gun ownership and to expand gun ownership and the rights and giving people rights to carry these things like we're back in the 1880s in Tucson, Arizona, that is tied to race and class. And that is evidence of the slow boiling war against us, as the white citizenry has watched the police become under more and more scrutiny for their murderous behavior. They fear that they're going to have to take on the job themselves.
Well, and when you think about the whole race class distinction, that happens here in Champaign-Urbana. You know, I've had conversations with people from the African-American community in Champaign who feel alienated from the African-American university community. So there's that divide as well. How can we work to overcome all of these different divides?
As someone who's part of both mm-hmm. of those things. Like,
right.
You know,
so you see this all the time, Liv.
Yeah, I grew up here for most of my life, and I also went to, like, the university here. I feel as though, like, a lot of people come in with the university mindset, you know, they're usually from, like, cities and
right,
suburbs.
They're not from here.
Right, exactly. Trying to bring, like, the, you know, same, like, beliefs, like, what's happening in Champaign, when actually, like, there's some differences around here amongst our Black communities. So not to, like, you know, look at us homogenized. And to bring that together, I would say more so just trying to find eye-to-eye touch to make things more accessible education-wise, like, you know, bring things down to their level. And I know it's like, as being a Black Lives Matter member, like, that's like, we have like a lot of university people. I'm like, you have to bring that down to more of a localized
level.
And
do you see that, Liv, like with the Black Lives Matter community on campus? How much are they engaged in things that are happening off campus?
They actually have like their own thing. It's not really a whole Black Lives Matter like thing in campus. Like, there's like black
you would
activism
say it's,
there.
Right. You would say that it's not
it's very,
just something that
right.
happens on campus.
It's very community based, whereas like Black Lives Matter here in the, here that I'm part of, we do deal with some campus issues, but we're trying to more so focus community-based since everything is already bubbled up in campus. So, like, no one really, like, you know, reaches out to the community because, you know, why would they? They're just going to leave after they're done here. So it's like trying to build that stability and connection here, especially amongst like the educational institutions, and trying to dismantle, like, you know, the systemic racism and classism amongst those and whatnot.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation. We're speaking with Liv Winston. She's a graduate student at the University of Illinois. As you said, you're just hearing her say, she's also involved with the Black Lives Matter movement here in the Champaign-Urbana area, and also with Sundiata Chajua, who teaches in the African-American Studies Department at the U of I. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. We'll continue this conversation in just a minute. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. My guests are Professor of History and African-American Studies at the University of Illinois, Sundiata Chajua, University of Illinois graduate. I need to correct what I said earlier. She's a graduate, not a graduate student. Liv Winston, she works in the Black Lives Matter movement in the Champaign-Urbana area. We've been talking about how all shootings don't receive equal or same attention. Of course, in light of the multiple shootings that occurred near the University of Illinois campus a couple weeks ago that unfortunately ended the life of one young man who was visiting. There's another young man who's now in custody for that. I wanted to ask both of you about, we've been talking about narrative and we've been talking about perception. And I think the overarching narrative for all of the people who are listening, most of the people who are listening to this conversation are in places where they think that this violence doesn't happen. That if you're in central Illinois, we heard that repeatedly in Champaign. In fact, I heard that from a student that we interviewed who had just come back from Chicago. And he said, hey, sorry, this is what I think of Chicago as a place that's violent. Places outside of Chicago are not violent. How do we, both of you are shaking your heads saying, absolutely not. How do we overcome that? Because I think that's a big narrative that plays into all of this as well.
I say get outside your campus bubble. Especially as
well, not just on campus. I think people in Peoria. I think
in Peoria,
people
yeah,
in, I think Peoria,
here.
Bloomington, Springfield. I think a lot of people would say that's part of the reason why they live in places like this because they think that these are places that do not have violence.
Well, they're kind of misinformed, especially as someone who's grown up here. Like I mentioned this in my article, a lot of people tend to have this mentality, even the locals, like nothing ever happens here. Well, you're not looking at within like not only like a class level, but like a race level, a sexism level, and even like a queerphobic level of like how violence happens here. And violence doesn't always have to be in front of your face.
It doesn't always have to be a shooting.
It doesn't always have to be shooting. It can be very subtle, and that's just as dangerous as well, because then we get into this normalized mindset of nothing ever happens here. And when we stay like that, we come up off guard and tend to try and solve our issues without long-term tactics to go about it.
Professor?
Well, this is a matter of who's the we. You know, to me, what the question indicates is the deep levels of class and race-based apartheid. In terms of residents, and particularly in terms of access to social institutions. So people who don't think that a lot of violence occurs in Champaign-Urbana simply don't have interactions with African-Americans. If they did, they would understand that African-Americans experience a lot of violence in this society. Much of it's structural, right? Mm-hmm. Unemployment.
And when you say structural,
poverty,
explain, yeah, you know, what do you mean by that?
I'm talking about if you look at quality of life indicators, and when you find people who are very, very low in those quality of life indicators, unemployment, they're high in terms of poverty, mass racialized incarceration, they're high on questions of police brutality, low on questions of home ownership, that those things create an inherent kind of violence. You know, you'll find that when the unemployment drops by 1%, you get X number of suicides, you get X number of homicides, you get X number of robberies, you get X number of all kinds of debilitating things that occur. So these things are tied to these social indexes, and those people who live on the bottom experience those things, and that is a violence because it's built into this society. There's no reason that makes sense other than capitalist exploitation that explains why people should be paid $8 an hour for labor, as opposed to 15 or 20. There's no reason to justify the ways in which the spatial configuration of this town, except for reasons of white supremacy. And so we have to challenge that. But the other narrative is that if you're talking about campus, well, campus people tend not to read the local newspaper. They tend not to watch the local news. They, you know, in their mind, they're somewhere else. So they show very little concern for what happens in the very space in which they live. And again, that has something to do with class background. It has more to do with class by race than it does to have to do with race. But all of those things, and until we begin to really talk about the role of structural violence in the same way that we talk about violence, and in the same time, I would argue that in any community, the greatest amount of crime occurs in the banking industry and in the financial sector. But they don't get arrested, right? But little black kids get arrested for jaywalking. Mm-hmm. So it's a matter of how you frame what is crime, because that's a social construct.
And in that sense, then what questions do you want people to be asking themselves the next time they hear about any of these incidents, the next time they think about this issue? Because we've talked about a lot of different things here. Liv, let me start with you.
Well, specific-wise, focusing on the Korchev and Patton issue, question yourselves, would we be thinking the same way if this wasn't a white university student compared to a white local around Champaign who didn't come from a background to afford a university education and whatnot? What else? More so how guns have been normalized within our cultures. Why do we choose, to go that route instead, and why they're so accessible as opposed to
That's all right, Professor.
But, yeah.
The loss of all life should be considered precious. And if they are incapable of coming up with the same level of empathy when someone who is dark and unknown to them is killed, as they are when someone who is white, then they got a real deep problem in terms of who they are as a person. So one, we need to be able to develop empathy for all people, and the move to create a just society begins with challenging very basic American values like the right for every idiot to have a gun. Really, we really don't need guns in a society.
That's Sundiata Chatjua. He teaches in history and African American studies at the University of Illinois. I want to thank Liv Winston with the Black Lives Matter movement in Champaign-Urbana for joining us as well. Thanks, guys. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
This is the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The Chicago Cubs celebrated one of its most memorable nights in franchise history last night. Let's take a listen.
Here's the 0-2 and a swing and a ground ball. Base hit up the middle into center. Hayward around third. He will come in to score. Javier Baez with an RBI single has given the Cubs a 6-5 lead. And the Cubs have stunned this crowd with a four-run ninth inning.
Historic ninth inning rally to finish off the San Francisco Giants last night and move on to the National League Championship Series for the second time in 2 years. The Cubs are trying to end a 108-year World Series drought. Cubs fans are having a hard time keeping their heart rates down through the playoffs. I'm not that big of a Cubs fan. Let me tell you, it was tough for me last night, so I have no idea how hard it was for Amar Madhani. He's a lifelong Cubs fan. We talked to him at the beginning of the season and wanted to check in with him today. He joins us on the phone from Chicago, where he's a correspondent for USA Today. Amar, welcome back to the 21st. How are you doing this morning?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. So can you take me through your emotions last night? Let's just go from eighth inning to ninth inning, because it was going from such a low point, am I saying?
So, if I could even go before that. Yeah,
go before that. It's okay.
Level. So it was very high, and going into the afternoon, about 3 or 4 yesterday afternoon, my very kind wife happened upon a church marquee, and she took a photo of it and she sent it to me. And the marquee said, "God wants the Cubs to win tonight." And that was a little bit of reassurance that she gave me, that divine intervention.
That's how you knew it was going to happen.
And it wasn't, I'm one of those guys that rolls their eyes whenever, an athlete attributes their success to God on the field. I saw that still, even my cynical heart saw that as a sign. And then I went going through the game and just, how lackluster they looked, and then thinking as going into the eighth inning.
Because it was awful. Let's just be honest. It was pretty bad.
And the body language, at one point they panned to Kyle Hendricks on the bench. And, his whole body, his shoulders and the way he was sitting there. He looked like a distraught teenager.
They kept cutting to Theo Epstein. He kept slumping lower and lower down into his chair.
It was looking at that, it was hard not to feel anxious and not to feel anxious about the possibility of facing Johnny Cueto in game 5.
How happy are you that this didn't go to a fifth game?
I'm extraordinarily happy. It's I don't even know how to describe how happy I was. I was stunned, speechless. On the Contreras base hit that tied the game, and then the poor sacrifice bunt that ended up getting Hayward to second base and putting him in scoring position. It just felt like there was some hand out there moving the pieces to make this happen.
The marquee was correct, right? So let's.
Was correct.
Let me ask you about, because when the season started, we talked to you back in May, and we should tweet out that conversation, by the way. If you follow 21st Show, we'll share that conversation we had with you before, because we talked about how, as a Cubs fan, as a lifelong Cubs fan, you're so used to the misery that goes with being a Cubs fan. That's basically been the last century of being a Cubs fan. That it's really hard to switch that mindset off. Have you been able to do that yet? Or are you still scared?
I think so. I think, well, one, the anxiety's there, and it's not going to go away until they win. But this is a really good team, and there's no reason why they shouldn't win the World Series this year. I think sort of winning exudes confidence. And the problem is I haven't seen a whole lot of winning in my life. So I haven't had a lot.
So you don't even know how to be confident as a Cubs fan. Well, and I also have to ask you, you are a correspondent for USA Today. This is a pretty busy time of year for us journalists. You've been covering the teacher strikes in Chicago. We have a campaign coming up. We have an election about to happen. And I'm thinking in particular of my colleague, who's our WILL Morning Edition host, who gets up at 4 in the morning to do Morning Edition, who I know at midnight was also a diehard Cubs fan. How are you managing sports? I love sports, but playoffs, it takes up a lot of time, man. How are you managing all of this?
I'm pretty sunk right now. Like, I actually just stepped out of a Senate candidate forum that Tammy Duckworth said.
Thank you. I appreciate you doing that to come on the program.
This is way more interesting. And no offense to Congresswoman Duckworth. The game that they lost in extra innings the other night was the same night as the teachers' strike negotiation going to the deadline. And, I found myself covering that, watching out of one eye as I'm waiting for the teachers to come out.
Did you stay up and watch all 13 innings, obviously.
Yeah, and then I was so distraught afterwards. I wasn't able to fall asleep till about 3 in the morning.
Yeah, I've heard this story from a couple of people now. Here's the question,
with my neighbors too.
I know that friends, particularly around Wrigley Field, were telling me last night about fireworks going off in Chicago. What is the mood like in Chicago this morning for sort of, especially a lot of people? I saw the tweets of people who were taking pictures of Wrigley Field at midnight and of the scoreboard outside saying that they had won the division. What's the mood like this morning in the city?
Well, I live in a little bit of a bubble. I live fairly close to Wrigley Field, and so I was hearing the fireworks, and I'm surrounded by Cubs fans and sort of the throes of the neighborhood. But I think it's pretty exuberant. I was in an Uber this morning, and I had a 20-minute ride or so, and I'd say 18 minutes of it was dedicated to talking about our excitement about the Cubs and our shared anxiety. It's also just a really nice salve in what's been a really tough year in Chicago. I've spent a lot of time, and Chicagoans have spent a lot of time thinking just about the violence and how that's affecting the city. We were also facing, I have a child in public school, and the idea that, as she's starting school, that she might have had to miss school for a while if there was a teacher strike. And so there's just been a lot bad stories and difficulties this year in Chicago and in the state in general. And so this has just been...
It's just a moment to savor, right? Really quick question for you, Armour. We're almost out of time. Really quick question. Who do you want to see the Cubs play in the NLCS?
I don't care.
You don't care?
I feel good. I think they're a better... Part of me would like to see them play Washington just because it'll be better on the
schedule. Washington. All right. Well, thanks for that. Game's Saturday night, so we'll be cheering for the Cubs. I should mention, for Blackhawks fans, the season begins NHL tonight as well. Thanks for tuning in to the 21st today. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Have a great day. Go Cubs.